Big Driver. 1. Tess accepted 12 compensated speaking engagements a year, if she could get them. At $1,200 each, that came to over $14,000. It was her retirement fund. She was still happy enough with the Willow Grove Knitting Society after 12 books, but didn't kid herself that she could go on writing them until she was in her 70s. If she did, what would she find at the bottom of the barrel? The Willow Grove Knitting Society goes to Terre Haute? The Willow Grove Knitting Society visits the International Space Station? No. Not even if the Ladies' Book Societies, who are her mainstay, read them. And they probably would. No. So she was a good little squirrel, living well on the money her books brought in, but putting away acorns for the winter. Each year for the last 10, she had put between $12,000 and $16,000 into her money market fund. The total wasn't as high as she might have wished, thanks to the gyrations of the stock market. But she told herself that if she kept on plugging, she'd probably be all right. She was the little engine that could. And she did at least 3 events each year gratis to salve her conscience. That often annoying organ should not have troubled her about taking honest money for honest work, but sometimes it did. Probably because running her gums and signing her name didn't fit the concept of work as she had been raised to understand it. Other than an honorarium of at least $1,200, she had one other requirement, that she be able to drive to the location of her lecture with not more than one overnight stop on the way to or from. This meant she rarely went farther south than Richmond or farther west than Cleveland. One night in a motel was tiring but acceptable. 2 made her useless for a week. And Fritzy, her cat, hated keeping house by himself. This he made clear when she came home, twining between her feet on the stairs and often making promiscuous use of his claws when he sat in her lap. And although Patsy McLean from next door was very good about feeding him, he rarely ate much until Tess came home. It wasn't that she was afraid of flying or hesitant about billing the organizations that engaged her for travel expenses, just as she billed them for her motel rooms. Always nice, never elegant. She just hated it. The crowding, the indignity of the full-body scans, the way the airlines now had their hands out for what used to be free, the delays, and the inescapable fact that you were not in charge. That was the worst. Once you went through the interminable security checkpoints and were allowed to board, you had put your most valuable possession, your life, into the hands of strangers. Of course, that was also true on the turnpikes and interstates she most always used when she traveled. A drunk could lose control, jump the median strip, and end your life in a head-on collision. They would live. The drunks, it seemed, always did. But at least when she was behind the wheel of her car, she had the illusion of control, and she liked to drive. It was soothing. She had some of her best ideas when she was on cruise control with the radio off. "I bet you were a long-haul trucker in your last incarnation," Patsy McLean told her once. Tess didn't believe in past lifetimes, or future ones, for that matter. In metaphysical terms, she thought what you saw was pretty much what you got. But she liked the idea of a life where she was not a small woman with an elfin face, a shy smile, and a job writing cozy mysteries, but a big guy with a big hat shading his sunburned brow and grizzled cheeks, letting a bulldog hood ornament lead him along the million roads that crisscross the country. No need to carefully match her clothes before public appearances in that life. Faded jeans and boots with side buckles would do. She liked to write, and she didn't mind public speaking, but what she really liked to do was drive. After her Chicopee appearance, this struck her as funny, but not funny in a way that made you laugh. No, not that kind of funny at all. 2. The invitation from Books and Brown Baggers filled her requirements perfectly. Chicopee was hardly more than 60 miles from Stoke Village. The engagement was to be a daytime affair, and the 3 B's were offering an honorarium of not $12,000, but $1,500. plus expenses, of course, but those would be minimal, not even a stay at a Courtyard Suites or a Hampton Inn. The query letter came from one Ramona Norville, who explained that although she was head librarian at the Chicopee Public Library, she was writing in her capacity as president of Books and Brown Baggers, which put on a noon lecture each month. People were encouraged to bring their lunches, and the events were very popular. Janet Ivanovich had been scheduled for October 12th, but had been forced to cancel because of a family matter, a wedding, or a funeral. Ramona Norville wasn't sure which. "I know this is short notice," Mrs. Norville said in her slightly wheedling final paragraph, "but Wikipedia says you live in neighboring Connecticut, and our readers here in Chicopee are such fans of the Knitting Society gals. You would have our undying gratitude, as well as the above-mentioned honorarium." Tess doubted that the gratitude would last much longer than a day or two, and she already had a speaking engagement lined up for October, Literary Cavalcade Week in the Hamptons. But I-84 would take her to I-90, and from 90, Chicopee was a straight shot. Easy in, easy out. Fritzy would hardly know she was gone. Ramona Norville had, of course, included her email address, and Tess wrote her immediately, accepting the date and the honorarium amount. She also specified, as was her wont, that she would sign autographs for no more than an hour. "I have a cat who bullies me if I'm not home to feed him his supper personally," she wrote. She asked for any further details, although she already knew most of what would be expected of her. She had been doing similar events since she was 30. Still, organizational types like Ramona Norville expected to be asked. And if you didn't, they got nervous and started to wonder if that day's hired writer was going to show up braless and tipsy. It crossed Tess's mind to suggest that perhaps $2,000 would be more appropriate for what was, in effect, a triage mission. But she dismissed the idea. It would be taking advantage. Also, she doubted if all the Knitting Society books put together, there were an even dozen, had sold as many copies as any one of Stephanie Plum's adventures. Like it or not, and in truth, Tess didn't mind much one way or the other, she was Ramona Norville's plan B. A surcharge would be close to blackmail. $1,500 was more than fair. Of course, when she was lying in a culvert, coughing out blood from her swollen mouth and nose, it didn't seem fair at all. But would 2,000 have been any fair? Or 2 million? Whether or not you could put a price tag on pain, rape, and terror was a question the Knitting Society ladies had never taken up. The crimes they solved were really not much more than the ideas of crimes. But when Tess was forced to consider it, she thought the answer was no. It seemed to her that only one thing could possibly constitute payback for such a crime. Both Tom and Fritzy agreed. 3. Ramona Norville turned out to be a broad-shouldered, heavy-breasted, jovial woman of 60 or so, with flushed cheeks, a marine haircut, and a take-no-prisoners handshake. She was waiting for Tess outside the library in the middle of the parking space reserved for today's author of note. Instead of wishing Tess a very good morning, it was 10:45, or complimenting her on her earrings, diamond drops, an extravagance reserved for her few dinners out and engagements like this, she asked a man's question. Had Tess come by the 84? When Tess said she had, Ms. Norville widened her eyes and blew out her cheeks. Glad you got here safe. 84 is the worst highway in America, in my humble opinion. Also, the long way around. We can improve the situation going back if the internet's right and you live in Stoke Village. Tess agreed that she did, although she wasn't sure she liked strangers, even a pleasant librarian, knowing where she went to lay down her weary head. But it did no good to complain. Everything was on the internet these days. I can save you 10 miles, Ms. Norville said as they mounted the library steps. Have you got a GPS? That makes things easier than directions written on the back of an envelope. Wonderful gadgets. Tess, who had indeed added a GPS to her expedition's dashboard array, it was called a tom-tom and plugged into the cigarette lighter, said that 10 miles off her return journey would be very nice. Better a straight shot through Robin Hood's barn than all the way around it, Miss Norville said and clapped Tess lightly on the back. Am I right or am I right? Absolutely, Tess agreed. And her fate was decided as simply as that. She had always been a sucker for a shortcut. 4. Les affaires du livre usually had 4 well-defined acts, and Tess's appearance at the monthly convocation of books and brown baggers could have been a template for the general case. The only diversion from the norm was Ramona Norville's introduction, which was succinct to the point of terseness. She carried no disheartening pile of file cards to the podium, felt no need to rehash Tess's Nebraska farm girl childhood, and did not bother producing bouquets of critical praise for the Willow Grove Knitting Society books. This was good, because they were rarely reviewed, and when they were, the name of Miss Marple was usually invoked, not always in a good way. Ms. Norville simply said that the books were hugely popular, a forgivable overstatement, and that the author had been extremely generous in donating her time on short notice. Although at $1,500, it was hardly a donation. Then she yielded the podium to the enthusiastic applause of the 400 or so in the library's small but adequate auditorium. Most were ladies of the sort who do not attend public occasions without first donning hats. But the introduction was more of an entre-act. Act 1 was the 11 o'clock reception, where the higher rollers got to meet Tess in person over cheese, crackers, and cups of lousy coffee. Evening events featured plastic glasses of lousy wine. Some asked for autographs, many more requested pictures, which they usually took with their cell phones. She was asked where she got her ideas and made the usual polite and humorous noises in response. Half a dozen people asked her how you got an agent, the glint of their eyes suggesting they had paid the extra $20 just to ask this question. Tess said you kept writing letters until one of the hungrier ones agreed to look at your stuff. It wasn't the whole truth. When it came to agents, there was no whole truth. But it was close. Act 2 was the speech itself, which lasted about 45 minutes. This consisted chiefly of anecdotes, none too personal, and a description of how she worked out her stories, back to front. It was important to insert at least 3 mentions of the current book's title, which that fall happened to be The Willow Grove Knitting Society Goes Spelunking. She explained what that was for those who didn't already know. Act 3 was question time, during which she was asked where she got her ideas. Humorous, vague response. If she drew her characters from real life, my aunts, and how one got an agent to look at one's work. Today she was also asked where she got her scrunchie, JCPenney, an answer which brought inexplicable applause. The last act was autograph time, during which she dutifully fulfilled requests to inscribe happy birthday wishes, happy anniversary wishes, to Janet, a fan of all my books, and to Leah, hope to see you at Lake Toxaway again this summer. A slightly odd request, since Tess had never been there, but presumably the autograph seeker had. When all the books had been signed and the last few lingerers had been satisfied with more cell phone pictures, Ramona Norville escorted Tess into her office for a cup of real coffee. Ms. Norville took hers black, which didn't surprise Tess at all. Her hostess was a black coffee type of chick if one had ever strode the surface of the earth, probably in Doc Martens on her day off. The only surprising thing in the office was the framed, signed picture on the wall. The face was familiar, and after a moment, Tess was able to retrieve the name from the junk heap of memory that is every writer's most valuable asset. Richard Widmark? Ms. Norville laughed in an embarrassed but pleased sort of way. My favorite actor. Had sort of a crush on him when I was a girl, if you want the whole truth. I got him to sign that for me 10 years before he died. He was very old, even then, but it's a real signature, not a stamp. This is yours. For one crazed moment, Tess thought Ms. Norville meant the signed photo. Then she saw the envelope in those blunt fingers, the kind of envelope with a window so you could peek at the check inside. "Thank you," Tess said, taking it. "No thanks necessary. You earned every penny." Tess did not demur. "Now, about that shortcut." Tess leaned forward attentively. In one of the Knitting Society books, Doreen Marquis had said, "The two best things in life are warm croissants and a quick way home." This was a case of the writer using her own dearly held beliefs to enliven her fiction. "Can you program intersections in your GPS?"
"Yes, Tom's very canny."
Ms. Norville smiled. "Input Stag Road and US 47, then. Stag Road is very little used in this modern age, almost forgotten since that damn 84, but it's scenic. You'll ramble along it for, 16 miles or so. Patched asphalt, but not too bumpy. Or wasn't the last time I took it. And that was in the spring when the worst bumps show up. At least that's my experience."
"Mine too," Tess said.
"When you get to 47, you'll see a sign pointing you to I-84. But you'll only need to take the turnpike for 12 miles or so. That's the beauty part. And you'll save tons of time and aggravation."
"That's also the beauty part," Tess said. And they laughed together. Two women of the same mind watched over by a smiling Richard Widmark. The abandoned store with the ticking sign was then still 90 minutes away, tucked snugly into the future like a snake in its hole. And the culvert, of course.
5. Tess not only had a GPS, she had spent extra for a customized one. She liked toys. After she had input the intersection, Ramona Norville leaned in the window as she did it, watching with manly interest. The gadget thought for a moment or two and then said, "Tess, I am calculating your route."
How about that?" Norville said,
and laughed the way that people do at some amiable peculiarity. Tess smiled, although she privately thought programming your GPS to call you by name was no more peculiar than keeping a fan photo of a dead actor on your office wall.
"Thank you for everything, Ramona. It was all very professional."
"We do our best at 3Bs. Now off you go, with my thanks."
"Off I go," Tess agreed. "And you're very welcome. I enjoyed it." This was true. She usually did enjoy such occasions in an all right, let's get this taken care of fashion. And her retirement fund would certainly enjoy the unexpected infusion of cash.
"Have a safe trip home," Norville said,
and Tess gave her a thumbs up. When she pulled away, the GPS said,
"Hello, Tess. I see we're taking a trip."
"Yes, indeed," she said. "And a good day for it, wouldn't you say?"
Unlike the computers in science fiction movies, Tom was poorly equipped for light conversation, although Tess sometimes helped him. He told her to make a right turn 400 yards ahead, then take her first left. The map on the TomTom screen displayed green arrows and street names, sucking the information down from some whirling metal ball of technology high above. She was soon on the outskirts of Chicopee, but Tom sent her past the turn for I-84 without comment and into countryside that was flaming with October color and smoky with the scent of burning leaves. After 10 miles or so on something called Old County Road, and just as she was wondering if her GPS had made a mistake, as if, Tom spoke up again. "In 1 mile, right turn." Sure enough, she soon saw a green Stag Road sign so pocked with shotgun pellets, it was almost unreadable. But of course, Tom didn't need signs. In the words of the sociologists, Tess had been a major before discovering her talent for writing about old lady detectives. He was other-directed.
"You'll ramble along for 16 miles or so," Ramona Norville had said.
But Tess rambled for only a dozen. She came around a curve, spied an old, dilapidated building ahead on her left, The faded sign over the pumpless service island still read SO, and then saw, too late, several large splintered pieces of wood scattered across the road. There were rusty nails jutting from many of them. She jounced across the pothole that had probably dislodged them from some country bumpkin's carelessly packed load, then veered for the soft shoulder in an effort to get around the litter, knowing she probably wasn't going to make it. Why else would she hear herself saying, "Uh-oh"? There was a clack-thump-thud beneath her as chunks of wood flew up against the undercarriage, and then her trusty expedition began pogoing up and down and pulling to the left like a horse that's gone lame. She wrestled it into the weedy yard of the deserted store, wanting to get it off the road so someone who happened to come tearing around that last curve wouldn't rear-end her. She hadn't seen much traffic on Stag Road, but there'd been some, including a couple of large trucks.
"God damn you, Ramona," she said.
She knew it wasn't really the librarian's fault. The head, and probably only member, of the Richard Widmark Fan Appreciation Society Chicopee branch had only been trying to be helpful. But Tess didn't know the name of the dummox who had dropped his nail-studded shit on the road and then gone gaily on his way, so Ramona had to do.
"Would you like me to recalculate your route, Tess?"
Tom asked, making her jump. She turned the GPS off, then killed the engine as well. She wasn't going anywhere for a while. It was very quiet out here. She heard bird song, a metallic ticking sound like an old wind-up clock, and nothing else. The good news was that the expedition seemed to be leaning to the left front instead of just leaning. Perhaps it was only the one tire. She wouldn't need a tow if that was the case. Just a little help from AAA. When she got out and looked at the left front tire, she saw a splintered piece of wood impaled on it by a large, rusty spike. Tess uttered a one-syllable expletive that had never crossed the lips of a knitting society member and got her cell phone out of the little storage compartment between the bucket seats. She would now be lucky to get home before dark, and Fritzy would have to be content with his bowl of dry food in the pantry. So much for Ramona Norville's shortcut. Although to be fair, Tess supposed the same thing could have happened to her on the interstate. Certainly she had avoided her share of potentially car-crippling crap on many throughways, not just I-84. The conventions of horror tales and mysteries, even mysteries of the bloodless, one-corpse variety enjoyed by her fans, was surprisingly similar. And as she flipped open her phone, she thought, in a story, it wouldn't work. This was a case of life imitating art, because when she powered up her Nokia, the words, "No service," appeared in the window. Of course. Being able to use her phone would be too simple. She heard an indifferently muffled engine approaching, turned, and saw an old white van come around the curve that had done her in. On the side was a cartoon skeleton pounding a drum kit that appeared to be made out of cupcakes. Written in drippy horror movie script above this apparition, much more peculiar than a fan photo of Richard Widmark on a librarian's office wall, were the words, "Zombie Bakers." For a moment, Tess was too bemused to wave, and when she did, the driver of the Zombie Baker's truck was busy trying to avoid the mess on the road and didn't notice her. He was quicker to the shoulder than Tess had been, but the van had a higher center of gravity than the expedition, and for a moment she was sure it was going to roll and land on its side in the ditch. It stayed up, barely, and regained the road beyond the spilled chunks of wood. The van disappeared around the next curve, leaving behind a blue cloud of exhaust and a smell of hot oil. "Damn you, zombie bakers," Tess yelled, then began to laugh. Sometimes it was all you could do. She clipped her phone to the waistband of her dress slacks, went out to the road, and began picking up the mess herself. She did it slowly and carefully, because up close it became obvious that all the pieces of wood, which were painted white and looked as if they had been stripped away by someone in the throes of a home renovation project, had nails in them. Big, ugly ones. She worked slowly because she didn't want to cut herself, but she also hoped to be out there, observably doing a good work of Christian charity, when the next car came along. But by the time she'd finished picking up everything but a few harmless splinters and casting the big pieces into the ditch below the shoulder of the road, no other cars had come along. Perhaps, she thought, the zombie bakers had eaten everyone in this immediate vicinity and were now hurrying back to their kitchen to put the leftovers into the always popular people pies. She walked back to the defunct store's weedy parking lot and looked moodily at her leaning car. $30,000 worth of rolling iron, four-wheel drive, independent disc brakes, Tom the talking tom-tom, and all it took to leave you stranded was a piece of wood with a nail in it. But of course they all had nails, she thought. In a mystery or a horror movie, that wouldn't constitute carelessness. That would constitute a plan. A trap, in fact. Too much imagination, Tessa Jean, she said, quoting her mother. And that was ironic, of course, since it was her imagination that had ended up providing her with her daily bread. Not to mention the Daytona Beach home where her mother had spent the last 6 years of her life. In the big silence, she again became aware of that tinny ticking sound. The abandoned store was of a kind you didn't see much in the 21st century. It had a porch. The left-hand corner had collapsed, and the railing was broken in a couple of places. But yes, it was an actual porch, charming even in its dilapidation. Maybe because of its dilapidation. Tess supposed general store porches had become obsolete because they encouraged you to sit a spell and chat about baseball or the weather, instead of just paying up and hustling your credit cards on down the road to some other place where you could swipe them at the checkout. A tin sign hung askew from the porch roof. It was more faded than the Esso sign. She took a few steps closer, raising a hand to her forehead to shade her eyes. You like it. It likes you. Which was a slogan for what, exactly? She had almost plucked the answer from her mental junk heap when her thoughts were interrupted by the sound of an engine. As she turned toward it, sure that the zombie bakers had come back after all, the sound of the motor was joined by the scream of ancient brakes. It wasn't the white van, but an old Ford F-150 pickup with a bad blue paint job and Bondo around the headlights. A man in bib overalls and a gimme cap sat behind the wheel. He was looking at the litter of wood scraps in the ditch. Hello, Tess called. Pardon me, sir? He turned his head, saw her standing in the overgrown parking lot, flicked a hand in salute, pulled in beside her expedition, and turned off his engine. Given the sound of it, Tess thought that an act tantamount to mercy killing. Hey there, he said. Did you pick that happy crappy up off the road? Yes. All but the piece that got my left front tire and my phone doesn't work out here, she almost added, then didn't. She was a woman in her late 30s who went 120 soaking wet, and this was a strange man, a big one. And here I am, she finished, a bit lamely. I'll change it for you if you got a spare, he said, working his way out of his truck. Do you? For a moment, she couldn't reply. The guy wasn't big. She'd been wrong about that. The guy was a giant. He had to go 6'6", but head to foot was only part of it. He was deep in the belly, thick in the thighs, and as wide as a doorway. She knew it was impolite to stare, another of the world's facts learned at her mother's knee. But it was hard not to. Ramona Norville had been a healthy chunk of a woman, but standing next to this guy, she would have looked like a ballerina. I know, he said, sounding amused. You didn't think you were going to meet the jolly green giant out here in the Willywags, did you? Only he wasn't green. He was tanned a deep brown. His eyes were also brown. Even his cap was brown, although faded almost white in several places, as if it had been splattered with bleach at some point in its long life. I'm sorry, she said. It's just that I was thinking, you don't ride in that truck of yours. You wear it. He put his hands on his hips and guffawed at the sky. Never heard it put like that before, but you're sort of right. When I win the lottery, I'm going to buy myself a Hummer. Well, I can't buy you one of those, but if you change my tire, I'd be happy to pay you $50.
You kidding? I'll do it for free. You saved me a mess of my own when you picked up that scrap wood.
Someone went past in a funny truck with a skeleton on the side, but he missed it. The big guy had been heading for Tess's flat front tire, but now he turned back to her frowning.
Someone went by and didn't offer to help you out?
I don't think he saw me.
Didn't stop to pick up that mess for the next fella either, did he?
No, he didn't.
Just went on his way?
Yes. There was something about these questions she didn't quite like. Then the big guy smiled, and Tess told herself she was being silly.
Spare under the cargo compartment floor, I suppose?
Yes, that is, I think so.
All you have to do is pull up on the handle. Yep, yeah. Been there, done that.
As he ambled around to the back of her expedition with his hands tucked deep into the pockets of his overalls, Tess saw that the door of his truck hadn't shut all the way and the dome light was on. Thinking that the F-150's battery might be as battered as the truck it was powering, she opened the door. The hinge screamed almost as loudly as the brakes, and then slammed it closed. As she did, she looked through the cab's back window and into the pickup's bed. There were several pieces of wood scattered across the ribbed and rusty metal. They were painted white and had nails sticking out of them. For a moment, Tess felt as if she were having an out-of-body experience. The ticking sign, "You like it, it likes you," now sounded not like an old-fashioned alarm clock, but a ticking bomb. She tried to tell herself the scraps of wood meant nothing. Stuff like that only meant something in the kind of books she didn't write and the kind of movies she rarely watched, the nasty, bloody kind. It didn't work, which left her with two choices. She could either go on trying to pretend, because to do otherwise was terrifying, or she could take off running for the woods on the other side of the road. Before she could decide, she smelled the whopping aroma of man sweat. She turned and he was there, towering over her with his hands in the side pockets of his overalls.
"Instead of changing your tire," he said pleasantly, "how about I fuck you? How would that be?"
Then Tess ran, but only in her mind. What she did in the real world was to stand pressed against his truck, looking up at him, a man so tall he blocked out the sun and put her in his shadow. She was thinking that not 2 hours ago, 400 people, mostly ladies in hats, had been applauding her in a small but entirely adequate auditorium. And somewhere south of here, Fritzy was waiting for her. It dawned on her, laboriously, like lifting something heavy, that she might never see her cat again.
"Please don't kill me,"
some woman said in a very small and very humble voice.
"You bitch," he said.
He spoke in the tone of a man reflecting on the weather. The sign went on ticking against the eave of the porch.
"You whiny whore bitch. Gosh sakes."
His right hand came out of his pocket. It was a very big hand. On the pinky finger was a ring with a red stone in it. It looked like a ruby, but it was too big to be a ruby. Tess thought it was probably just glass. The sign ticked.
"You like it, it likes you."
Then the hand turned into a fist and came speeding toward her, growing until everything else was blotted out. There was a muffled metallic bang from somewhere. She thought it was her head colliding with the side of the pickup truck's cab. Tess thought, "Zombie bakers." Then for a little while, it was dark. 6. She came to in a large, shadowy room that smelled of damp wood, ancient coffee, and prehistoric pickles. An old paddle fan hung crookedly from the ceiling just above her. It looked like the broken merry-go-round in that Hitchcock movie, Strangers on a Train. She was on the floor, naked from the waist down, and he was raping her. The rape seemed secondary to the weight, He was also crushing her. She could barely draw a breath. It had to be a dream. But her nose was swollen. A lump that felt the size of a small mountain had grown at the base of her skull, and splinters were digging into her buttocks. You didn't notice those sorts of details in dreams. And you didn't feel actual pain in dreams. You always woke up before the real pain started. This was happening. He was raping her. He had taken her inside the old store, and he was raping her while golden dust motes twirled lazily in the slanting afternoon sun. Somewhere people were listening to music and buying products online and taking naps and talking on phones. But in here, a woman was being raped, and she was that woman. He had taken her underpants. She could see them frothing from the pocket in the bib of his overalls. That made her think of Deliverance, which she had watched at a college film retrospective back in the days when she had been slightly more adventurous in her movie going.
"Get them panties down," one of the hillbillies had said before commencing to rape the fat townie. It was funny what crossed your mind when you were lying under 300 pounds of country meat with a rapist's cock creeping back and forth inside you like an unoiled hinge.
"Please," she said. "Oh, please, no more."
"Lots more," he said. And here came that fist again, filling her field of vision. The side of her face went hot. There was a click in the middle of her head, and she blacked out. 7. The next time she came to, he was dancing around her in his overalls, tossing his hands from side to side and singing "Brown Sugar" in a squalling atonal voice. The sun was going down, and the abandoned store's two west-facing windows, the glass dusty but miraculously unbroken by vandals, were filled with fire. His shadow danced behind him, capering down the board floor and up the wall, which was marked with light squares where advertising signs had once hung. The sound of his clutting work boots was apocalyptic. She could see her dress slacks crumpled under the counter where the cash register must once have stood, probably next to a jar of boiled eggs and another of pickled pig's feet. She could smell mold, and oh God, she hurt. Her face, her chest, most of all down below, where she felt torn open.
"Pretend you're dead. It's your only chance."
She closed her eyes. The singing stopped, and she smelled approaching man sweat, sharper now.
"Because he's been exercising," she thought.
She forgot about playing dead and tried to scream. Before she could, his huge hands gripped her throat and began to choke.
She thought, "It's over. I'm over."
They were calm thoughts, full of relief. At least there would be no more pain, no more waking to watch the monster man dance in the burning sunset light. She passed out.
5.